You're listening to The Pivot, brought to you by Globally News, where we discuss the leaders, states, networks, ideologies, and technologies that are reshaping the world order. Visit our website at globally.news. That's globe.news.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Pivot. My name is Arif Rafiq, and I'm your host. India's general elections are set to begin this month. These polls will take place over seven stages, culminating on June 1st. And when the final votes are counted, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, is widely expected to return to power. For Modi, a third consecutive term as Prime Minister is on the horizon. In his 10 years in power, Modi has radically transformed India, all but eliminating its secular edifice and deeply eroding its once vaunted democratic institutions. The Hindu nationalist leader has not only upended India's political norms and social order, he's also transformed its economy, with the country experiencing rapidly growing inequality. The changes under Modi at the national level reflect a style of rule honed during his 13 years as chief minister of the state of Gujarat, where his tenure began with the state-backed pogroms in 2002 that took the lives of over 1,000 Muslims. In this episode, we'll discuss the fundamental features of the Modi model, including crony capitalism and a vigilante-backed system of surveillance, fashioned in Gujarat and applied nationally over the past decade. And we'll assess what India after Modi might look like and whether democracy and secularism can bounce back once his reign has come to an end. To discuss all this, we're joined by Dr. Christoph Jaffrelot, a professor of Indian politics and sociology at King's College London. He's the author, most recently, of Gujarat Under Modi, a book released this year by Hearst Publishers that studies how Modi's Gujarat served as a laboratory for a new type of Hindu majoritarianism in national populism and caste and class politics. Dr. Jaffrelot is a leading expert on the Hindu nationalist ideology known as Hindutva, and his writing on the topic is indispensable to anyone who seeks to understand this radical ideology. Now, before we begin, I'll just introduce a few names that we mention often in the show. The Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, or the RSS, is the parent organization of Modi's BJP. It leads a network of Hindu nationalist organizations known as the Sangh Parivar. And Gautam Adani and Mukesh Ambani are India's two richest men. Adani, head of the Adani Group, has a net worth of over $80 billion, and Ambani, head of Reliance Industries, has a net worth of roughly $116 billion. Their wealth has skyrocketed under Modi. And now to our show. Dr. Jaffrelot, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for your invitation.
So in your book, you talk about the Gujarat model that Modi establishes as chief minister of the state. He ruled from 2001 to 2014, and you and others have described Gujarat under Modi as a laboratory of Hindutva, the Hindu nationalist ideology. I'd like you to explain what you mean by the laboratory of Hindutva, and what type of model did Modi end up establishing there? What are its core elements?
Yeah, I don't use the word model, he did, but indeed laboratory. And the reason why I use this word is that clearly, now we have enough perspective, he learned how to win power and to exert power in Gujarat and was in a position in 2014 to start scaling up what he had invented in Gujarat at the national level. And this is completely unprecedented. This is for the first time that a chief minister becomes a prime minister in India. There was only one very brief episode with De Gowda of the same type. But for the first time, we had someone who had used a state as a launch pad in a position to replicate at the national level what he had invented at the regional level. And what he has invented at the regional level is based on few components. The core elements are: one, polarization, communal polarization, Hindu-Muslim based polarization, the cleavages between these two groups. Two, deinstitutionalization of the rule of law, targeting the police and the judiciary primarily. Three, a very specific political economy based on a new brand of crony capitalism and new forms of inequalities, at least inequalities of a larger magnitude. And of course, that's it goes without saying, but we need to, of course, mention it, a specific way to relate to the people, a national populist repertoire that results in the making of what has been called Modidva, a kind of encapsulation of Hindutva and a very personal way to relate to the voters. And the last element has to do with the support base of this politics. Modi has never won more than 51% of the votes. Who are these people? Who are the support, the supporters? And the supporters come from elite groups, mostly, including dominant castes. And they are the same supporters in 2014. So, yes, this is why I consider that there is a successful scaling up of regional pattern to a national one. And that's, I repeat, completely unprecedented in India. A mystery in many ways.
Yeah. And so we'll unpack these one by one and relate them to the present. And your book does an excellent job of really identifying how this model took form, because it took form over time in India or in Gujarat and was then later translated to the national level. First, I want to take on this personalist model of Hindutva, which you and others have called Moditva. Now, this is a deviation from the playbook of Modi's party, the Bharatiya Janata Party, and its parent organization, the RSS, which is short for Rashtriya Swayam Sevak Sangh, where the worker and the leader are really subservient to the organization and the ideology. And Modi really upends that in Gujarat. And I'd like you to talk to us about how this shift took place in Gujarat under Modi. And in your book, you actually identify signs going back to the 1990s that Modi was really going to try to play by his own rules. So how did Modi remake the Hindu nationalist ideology in his own image?
Yeah, the ideology itself indeed remains the same, but the way he uses it is indeed completely new. Completely new for the reasons you've just mentioned. BJP leaders used to report to the RSS at the state level, at the national level. BJP leaders used to be team players and at the national level, Vajpayee and Advani formed a duo for decades. Here is a man who does something completely new. He stops reporting to the RSS leaders at the state level first and then at the national level. And he starts embodying the party as a personal tool. And that is very different. Let's return to these two dimensions. After winning the 2002 elections, Modi emancipated himself from the rest of the Sangh Parivar. Of course, he is a product. He's a pure product of the RSS. He was himself a Swayam Sevak as a child when he was only 7 or 8. He was, of course, a full-time officer, a Pratcharak, who toured India, being sent by the organization to different posts. Well, he toured mostly Gujarat, but he went also elsewhere in India. But when he became chief minister, he built his own parallel power structure and stopped reporting to the Pratcharak, something he used to be himself when he was an RSS person only. After becoming a BJP person, a BJP leader, he did not report to Manmohan Vaid, who was the Prime Minister, and who was transferred to Chennai after the bone of contention became too sensitive. So that's something new, that you can understand because of his personal ambition. He wanted to embody the organization. And that goes with the second point. When he replaced Keshubhai Patel, who was the chief minister till 2001, when he was parachuted from Delhi, where he had been transferred, instead of paying somewhat allegiance, or at least instead of acknowledging that Keshubhai Patel, who had built BJP, Tan Sang and then BJP in Gujarat to Mr. Nixon, he sidelined the old man, the veteran of Gujarat politics, and there was a real battle. So he captured the party sidelined Keshubhai Patel, who created his own party finally in 2012. Well, these two dimensions, the fact that he did not report to the RSS as a chief minister in Gujarat, the fact that he marginalized his predecessor, a senior, a BJP leader, will be repeated at the national level. When Mohan Bhagwat, the RSS chief, tried to give advice to Narendra Modi in 2014, he was told that he did not need any advice, and Modi never reported to Bhagwat either. Similarly, when he succeeded or replaced Advani as a candidate for prime ministership in 2013-2014, he marginalized Advani, and not only Advani, senior most figures of BJP like Muralidhar Manohar Joshi and many others. So this is one of the fascinating parts of the story. There is a real repetition of major features of his Gujarat period when he became a national figure. And the book is about that, how a regional experiment can be repeated at the national level.
Right, right. And yeah, and at the local level, at the state level in Gujarat, there's some interesting anecdotes in your book where, you know, there's potential involvement in the murder of a rival, Harin Pandya, and then there's also spying that the state does conducts on other rivals of Modi in this early period after he was elected in 2002. This is after the Gujarat riots or the pogroms. Now, practically speaking, at a national level, in terms of how decisions are made, we really have like a kitchen cabinet that is formed with Amit Shah and Ajit Doval. It's really a handful of people that are ultimately around Modi that are ultimately making decisions, right? And this is a real departure from the past where, let's say, previous BJP Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee would be beholden to some degree to the head of the parent organization, the RSS, right?
Exactly. In fact, this is one more difference, big difference, but very similar to what was the modus operandi in Gujarat precisely. In Gujarat already, very few ministers did matter. Of course, Amit Shah, as old minister or right-hand man of Modi, did matter. But very few others played any significant role. Similarly, at the national level, you see a big difference with what the Vajpayee government used to be. You know, under Vajpayee, you had key ministers, Jaswant Singh, Jaswant Sinha, of course, Advani, Arun Shurye, you know, they were personalities who followed policies with some competence. Well, things have changed a lot. To the two or three people you've listed, I would add Jay Shankar, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, But yes, a handful of people are doing the job. The PMO is ruling the country and relates directly to the ministries, but to the bureaucrats who are at the helm of the ministries. So that's one more element in the personalization of power. Not only the party has been captured, but the government has been reduced to a minimum. And you could continue the list with other institutions. Parliament hardly plays any role today. Parliament has been short-circuited on so many occasions. This is a reconfirmation that we have a populist regime, because the populist relates directly to the people and does not need a party and does not need a parliament and does not need a government. Because he is the people. And when you are the people, you don't report to anybody else. You do not depend from anybody else except the voters. And that's why there are elections, because the elections are needed for getting the legitimacy and for making it possible for the man to say, I am you, I am your voice, to repeat, by the way, what Donald Trump used to say.
Right. And you know, we see this playing out in many countries across the world, including in the United States and on the fringes of Europe and Hungary and elsewhere. And what's interesting for me is that obviously in many of these cases, we have a strongman figure that emerges who supplants norms and state institutions. But in the case of Modi and the RSS, you know, the RSS is a pretty regimented organization. It operates on the basis of consensus. And so in addition to the elements of the Indian constitution that serve as constraints against authoritarianism, there also was a culture within the RSS that at least mitigated the emergence of a single persona having a dominant role in politics. But Modi has not only eviscerated the opposition, but also those kind of guardrails within the Hindu nationalist movement that would at least slow the path to a single individual consolidating power. And so those checks are kind of gone within the BJP RSS structure, and it points towards Modi's ambition and his success as a politician who sought to really capture power. Now, you'd also talked about the capture of state institutions in your book, and you mentioned it, your response to the initial question that we began this discussion with. And so in Gujarat, one of those key elements is the communalization of the police force. And so instead of being beholden to the state or the constitution, the police in Gujarat essentially became beholden to an ideology, a party, and a leader. And the courts were also neutered. So talk to us about how that played out in Gujarat and then at a national level.
Yeah, this is a very important component, of course, of the laboratory that was Gujarat. Well, it's largely a sequel of the pogrom in the case of the police, because during the pogrom, some policemen did their job or tried to do their job, when others let the vigilantes, Bajangdal people and others do their own job and therefore betrayed the constitution of India. They were rewarded. They were the ones who were rewarded. When those who tried to stop the violence were sidelined or sometimes even dismissed. And that was the beginning of a shift that continued after 2003 with a series of fake encounters between 2003 and 2007. You have something like half a dozen major fake encounters. The typical scenario was a Muslim man like Sohrabuddin was killed because the police said he intended to kill Narendra Modi himself. So this idea that the police was protecting the chief minister from Islamists, jihadists, was very much used for polarizing society. You know, after the pogrom, polarization continued on the basis of these fake encounters, which were very much publicized. And policemen like Von Zara, who was very much involved in many of these fake encounters, gave press conferences saying, we have eliminated X or Y, what come from Pakistan, what come from elsewhere, for killing our chief minister. That is an important factor in the politicization of the police. And this is something you will find after 2014 in a different manner, but not in a radically different manner, when the Central Bureau of Investigation could not retain its chief because of his secular credentials. And Narendra Modi tried hard to bring in the CBI and also the NIA, IPS, inspectors of police, coming from Gujarat cadres, people who had already been part of his type of governance in Gujarat. And the CBI and the NIA have been largely emasculated and neutralized because of this strategy. Saffronization of the police at the national level took place along lines rather similar to what he had done in Gujarat. Regarding the judiciary, we have a very interesting parallel also. And again, in Gujarat, it's largely a sequel of the pogrom. You know, after the pogrom, of course, many people try to get some justice and file FIR. It was not easy, but as I show in the book, finally, with the support of the Supreme Court, many people could do it. The problem was that the government appointed prosecutors, which were all part of the Hindu nationalist movement and who systematically made the life of the plaintiffs very difficult. Not only that, but we saw the Solicitor General, and before that, the man who played that role at the state level, Tushar Mehta, also playing a very dubious role in Gandhinagar and Ahmedabad. Well, very interestingly, the same people, including Tushar Mehta, followed Narendra Modi and Amit Shah in Delhi after 2014. You know, Tushar Mehta had defended Amit Shah in the Sohrabuddin Sheikh case, and he was appointed additional Solicitor General in 2014 itself, and then Solicitor General of India in 2018. He was not the only one. Mr. S.V. Raju, who had been practicing at the Gujarat High Court and had been Amit Shah's lawyer in different cases, was also appointed as additional Solicitor General at the Supreme Court of India in 2020. So you see a continuity because of the people themselves who travel from Gujarat to Delhi. But of course, in the case of the judiciary at the center, what was more difficult to achieve was to neutralize the Supreme Court of India. That was one of the objectives. And you may remember that immediately after taking over power in 2014, the first thing the government of Narendra Modi tried to do was to reform the way the judges of the Supreme Court were appointed. The idea being to make sure that in the committee appointing judges, the justices, the non-lawyers, the people who were not lawyers, would be in a majority. It failed, this attempt at changing the way judges were appointed failed, but Modi and his government could take revenge. Certainly till today, the collegium system continues and judges select the lawyers who will become part of the Supreme Court. But when those they have selected are not of the liking of the government, they're not appointed. And that was a bone of contention as early as 2016, 2015 even. But gradually, the collegium somewhat resigned itself to this situation and finally decided to select only lawyers who would be reconfirmed, appointed by the government of India. So that you have here a good explanation why the court has been so complacent. The Supreme Court of India for years, in fact, till this year, between 2015 and 2024, has not opposed the government of India on any issue, be it Ayodhya, be it Article 370, be it Aadhaar, be it the electoral bonds. You know, you name one main issue and you see the Supreme Court validating the government's decision, which is completely unprecedented in the history of India. The court used to be a very important alternative power center. So, to cut a long story short, the way the court has been targeted, the way the police have been targeted in Gujarat has been reiterated at the national level. And that is very surprising, that you can achieve at the national level something of that magnitude is very revealing of the weaknesses of the institutions, certainly, but also strength of the man in charge at the center, because you need a lot of strength, a lot of determination for achieving such an amazing transformation of the institutions.
Right. And that brings to mind several statements that were made over the years by Alice Wells, who was the top State Department official for South Asia in the Trump administration. And when she was pressed by members of the policy community and Congress on the backsliding of democracy, fundamental rights in India, she'd often made statements saying that, you know, democracies like India are self-correcting, that India's institutions, democratic institutions are working. And she'd made these statements after these, you know, very big events took place, whether it was the abrogation of Article 370 and then some other decisions. And you know, generally she was forced to present herself before Congress subject to, you know, somewhat intense questioning from members who are, you know, very skeptical and concerned about where India is headed. And it points to how there's a stark divide between, I think, the policy discourse, or at least what we're hearing from senior U.S. officials, and the reality on the ground. And what your book demonstrates is that this is a playbook that was shaped in Gujarat and applied at the national level, literally using many of the same individuals who helped implement those changes. And by virtue of their loyalty to Narendra Modi, they rose to the national level as well. Now, federalism has also been described by many as a restraining force on the BJP and Modi's attempts to consolidate power. But the BJP has worked to erode that as well, right? You know, the recent arrest of Arvind Kejriwal, the head of the opposition Aam Aadmi Party, is seen by some as an attempt to weaken federalism and the power of opposition-controlled states. And then there's also been a decline in, for example, the amount of revenue that's been going to states, at least in terms of their share of the divisible pool of tax revenue. So talk to us about how the Modi government has really engaged in an onslaught on federalism.
Yes, and this is, of course, the only difference between what he did in Gujarat and what he does at the national level. Because when he was chief minister, he complained all the time, saying that Delhi was centralizing power to a greater extent than necessary. Of course, as a chief minister, he wanted more federalism. But as a prime minister, is delivering less federalism. You've mentioned example illustrations of this process. I would add only two significant other illustrations. One is, of course, demonetization. Demonetization is 2016 was decided without consulting the chief ministers, not even the BJP chief ministers. No, something that goes directly against the spirit of federalism, at least the way India had practiced federalism so far. Similarly, the lockdown. When the lockdown was decided, it was something that took everybody by surprise, including the chief ministers of the states who had to organize the lockdown itself. Well, there would be many, many other examples going in the same direction. Indeed, India is more centralized than probably ever before, at least since Mrs. Gandhi's era. There is, by the way, a very clear similarity between the way Mrs. Gandhi weakened federalism and the way Narendra Modi is weakening federalism in India. That is the way chief ministers are appointed. Mrs. Gandhi appointed non-entities who were yes men. Similarly, Narendra Modi is not letting state party bosses asserting themselves at the state level, at the regional level. When you vote for BJP in a state election, you don't know who will be the chief minister if BJP wins. Modi is canvassing, is doing the campaign. The same way, by the way, he canvassed at the local level for municipal elections when he was chief minister. So he is repeating once again the same modus operandi. Which is, again, something very different from what BJP used to be. BJP used to be a kind of cadre-based party with strong regional bosses. Behram Singh Shekhawat for Rajasthan. Well, the list would be very long if we start giving it. Now, on the contrary, the chief ministers do not matter, and that is affecting federalism even more. Still, if there is one place, one institution resisting or constraining Modi's power, it is at the state level. The South, Tamil Nadu, of course, Kerala, of course, but also now Telangana, Andhra Pradesh, Karnataka are not governed by BJP anymore. None of the five southern states is governed by BJP. The North-South divide has probably never been so pronounced, and it's a reflection of some resistance, which is not, of course, good for the country because it means more divisions, more acrimony, and the relations are not good. The South is complaining. The South complains that it is paying for the North because, of course, it is now more educated. It is much richer. The per capita revenue is much higher than anywhere in the north, including Gujarat. And I show in my book that Gujarat is not a model in socioeconomic terms. It's lagging behind Tamil Nadu, for instance, in many ways. But this resistance, this resilience of federalism in the south may not be for, may not make any difference if there is a redelimitation of the constituencies according to the new demography of India. And this is what may happen very soon. As you may know, everything had been frozen in the 70s in order not to reward the states not observing family planning. The defreezing of the constituencies of India means that because of its demography, the North will send to Parliament many more members than the South, and that will neutralize federalism even more, because the North that is already dominant will be even more dominant.
Right, and it seems like Modi could be attempting to do to the South what he did to the Muslim vote, both in Gujarat and at the national level, which is sort of marginalize them and render them in irrelevant to some degree, because they are these outlying forces that are resistant to his attempts to consolidate power. Now, you had mentioned Indira Gandhi and the sort of precedent that she established in terms of these attempts to reduce federalism. And, you know, she's also well known for imposing emergency. And many today say that India is in an undeclared emergency. Given all of this, given all of what you've described, would you say that Modi is India's most powerful PM ever, or maybe Nehru would fall into that category?
Well, there is no comparison. Nehru had to write a letter to the chief ministers every 15 days. And I really invite you to read these volumes and fortnightly letters. They are really showing that everything had to be negotiated. And Nehru had to, for instance, bow to the chief ministers who wanted the map of India to be redrawn according to the linguistic principle in the 50s, 53, 54. No, this is a different model, indeed, much closer to Indira Gandhi's model. And Indira Gandhi possibly had as much power as Narendra Modi, but briefly, in the 70s. Of course, during the emergency, but probably after the 71 election already. Today, we speak about someone who is already exerting that much power for 10 years and may be doing possibly the same for 5 more years. And you know, when you have such a strong man at the helm for such a long period, you change a political system potentially. And in fact, this is what we are seeing, what is happening.
Right. The one more interesting ideas that you articulate in your book is this idea of the deeper state, the role of Hindutva vigilante groups in ensuring conformity to a Hindu dominant culture. And these are really upper caste practices and beliefs in terms of conformity to a vegetarian lifestyle and all that. Talk to us about how that has emerged as a fundamental component of this model that Modi establishes in Gujarat and then at a national level.
Yes, and this is where the Sangpa River needs to be brought back in the picture. Because certainly Modi has created a kind of parallel power structure. Certainly he relates directly to the voters by using the media, he saturates the public sphere by using social media, by using television. And when he was in Gujarat, he created his own TV channel for relating even more effectively to the people. So yes, this is personal technique. He relied on PR firm, including an American one, APCO Worldwide. He relied on Prashant Kishore in 2012, a professional marketer for politicians. But the Sangpa River continued to play an important role. And even though RSS did not appreciate, I mean, RSS leaders did not appreciate his style, volunteers did. And it's one of the reasons, by the way, why RSS leaders could not ignore Modi in 2013, 2014, because he was very popular among the Swayam Sevaks, among the grassroots cadres, militants and cadres. They are the people who have routinized vigilantism. So what do we mean by vigilantism? Vigilantism is a technique of cultural policing to control society at the grassroots level, to penetrate society in order to impose norms and values, because usually the vigilantes claim that they are defending almost sacred values. Hinduism is a religion that needs to be promoted, defended, and its values or the way they interpret these values have to be imposed on society. It may be illegal because the constitution says otherwise, but the secular constitution for them is not legitimate. And there is a hiatus between legitimacy and legality. This is something we see very clearly when we look at the way they operate vis-a-vis Muslims. The Muslims are their primary target at the local level, at the grassroots level. So they will fight, for instance, against what they call love jihad. Love jihad for them is a technique Muslim men are developing for seducing Hindu girls, converting Hindu girls, marrying Hindu girls. And therefore, they patrol the university campuses, they patrol the cities for making sure that Muslim men don't talk to Hindu girls. That's cultural policy. But of course, it reaches another level when you look at the Gaurakshaks, who are protecting the cow and therefore patrolling the highways to watch the trucks whose drivers are Muslims and which could take cows to the slaughterhouse. So they are checking what is in these trucks. And when there is a bovine, the risk of the driver, the Muslim driver, to be lynched is very high. That's another way to maintain their own vision of order, social order, religious order. But what is interesting also in the case of the vigilante groups is that they control almost in the name of the same values their own society. And for instance, the Bajrang Dalis, who were very active in Gujarat, for instance, Babu Bajrang Dal, who was so active during the 2002 pogrom, was also very active in making sure that no intercaste marriage should took place in Gujarat. He was a Patel himself, Babu Bajrangi, and he could help Patel families, the parents of Patel girls who had eloped with someone from a different caste, to retrieve the couple and to bring them back all. So autopraxy, the Hindu vision of the autopraxy, including the caste system, is part of this vision of the good society. And the vigilantes are representing a deeper state in the sense that they help the state, the official state, they help the police to maintain a certain order, a certain social and moral order. Because the police is supposed to do the same job. They are supposed to protect the cows. They are supposed to, of course, help the parents who are asking for their daughter to be back home. It's a joint venture. It's a joint venture between the vigilantes and the official police. But of course, the vigilantes are much more motivated. There are many more. They are very numerous. They are big groups. And therefore, by relying on vigilante groups, the Hindu nationalist movement is making the state deeper to such an extent that sometimes we may wonder whether a change of guard at the government level, an alternation in power, bringing back the opposition parties of today, would make any significant change. Would Muslims escape vigilantism if BJP lost power? If at the grassroots level, the same groups would continue to impose their cultural policy? This is a major question because it shows that politics is not the alpha and omega of social life. And you may have elections, you may lose elections, but it may not make such a huge difference for those who are at the receiving end today.
Right. And we'll get to that question of how enduring these changes are towards the end of our discussion. But, you know, this campaign of forcible assimilation, where we see a parallel state where the party and the party grassroots performs functions alongside the formal state, it reminds me in some ways of China and the Chinese Communist Party. Do you see parallels between the CCP and the broader Sangh Parivar?
Certainly, there are similarities. I would say, first, the way this mode of governance rely on fear. Fear has become palpable in many social milieus, political milieus. Fear of an ED raid, fear of an income tax raid, but fear, of course, of physical attacks as well. That's certainly something that is common to many authoritarian regimes, including the Chinese one. Another common feature probably has to do with surveillance. You know, surveillance, again, is something you find in many different places, but it has been probably sophisticated, reached a very sophisticated level in China. In the book, I focus on the first attempt at making surveillance a governance technique in Gujarat, tapping the phone of opponents, for instance, became very commonplace, and it has been certainly routinized at the national level. The Pegasus story is bearing testimony of this. Facial recognition, the use of Aadhaar also. Yes, and it's not only for the Indians living in India, it's also for the diaspora. And that's, by the way, something the Chinese have implemented too, to control the diaspora. But in the case of the diaspora, it's more the Communist Party that continues to do the job. For the Indian diaspora, surveillance comes more from the state apparatus itself, from the diplomats themselves, and from the organizations of the Sangh Parivar, because the Sangh Parivar is now a completely transnational organization. you have Hindu Sivak song in UK, in the US, Canada, and it's another organization, another type of organization than that is not exactly a replica of the Communist Party of India, but working together with the official state and the high commissions or the embassies. You have another example there of the joint venture I was talking about. The same way you have the police and the vigilantes working together at the grassroots level in India, you have the Tsongpo River and the embassies working together in the diaspora. I mean, abroad, where there is a diaspora.
Right, that fusion of the power of the party and the movement grassroots and the state brings to mind a conversation I had with a journalist based in India. And she had told me that before she was about to leave the country, she was approached by an official from the RSS who had told her that he knew she was going to be leaving the country for travel, and then gave her some sort of warning about her behavior because she's from a Muslim background. And so that points toward that individual being supplied with confidential information by the state entity and playing this role in what is ultimately a surveillance state that is established in different forms in different parts of the country, but in areas where Muslims are more concentrated or opposition forces are more concentrated, we may see things at a far more severe level. Now, the sort of final element of this model that Modi establishes is crony capitalism, and it's taken to new heights under Modi's premiership, where the super rich like Adani and Ambani, their net worth has just multiplied, even as incomes have largely stagnated in India. And this includes during the COVID period. So talk to us about this nexus between Modi and Adani and Ambani, and then there are some other plutocrats who are part of this mix. How does it emerge in Gujarat? And what does it say about the state of economic development in India? Because arguably, there is growth without development, right?
Yes, and Gujarat, again, was the blueprint of this very specific political economy. Well, Gujarat is a state where businessmen have always played a major role. And not only merchant castes or Parsis, but also Patels, the main caste, agrarian caste, which has turned to the economy, becoming more urbanized and investing in all kinds of activities. Of course, cooperatives like Amul, for dairy products or pharmaceuticals. And you have so many companies being part of the generics industry in Gujarat. So there was this context. But in this context, Modi supported few individuals and promoted mega projects at the expense of the small and medium enterprises, the SMEs. The SMEs were very numerous and active before Modi. They remained so, but the rise of big oligarchs finally was at the expense of these SMEs. So who are these? Who were these oligarchs? Well, the usual suspects, of course, because we know them all. The big Indian businessmen are most of them from Gujarat. So when Ratan Tata was looking for a place for his factory, the Nano factory, after things became complicated in West Bengal, he turned to Modi, or Modi invited him on instead, and he could make this factory in Gujarat. The Essar Group had his refinery, of course, in Gujarat. The Ambanis were Gujarat is based in Gujarat. Dhirubhai Ambani started there, and Reliance started there. But Of course, the most interesting case is Gautam Adani, who was a very small entrepreneur in the early 2000s, hardly noticed by anyone, till after the pogrom, he supported Modi against other businessmen. Now, after the pogrom, Godrej, Rahul Bajaj, Azim Premji were very critical of the way riots had disrupted the economy and of course social life. So there was a rather tense meeting of the Confederation of Indian Industry that I described in detail in the book. And Gautam Adani came to the rescue of Narendra Modi, not alone, with a group of similar entrepreneurs, but he took the lead and he was rewarded for that, clearly. He was rewarded immediately with the creation of an SEZ in Mundra. And Mundra, in 15 years, has become the number one port in India. And this SEZ is an amazing success story. Well, SEZs, by the way, was the most favorite modus operandum for Narendra Modi. Gujarat had something like 60 SEZs by the end of his second term in Gujarat. And one of the main beneficiaries of these SEZs, special economic zones, was Gautam Adani, because he also became very powerful in the domain of energy, electricity, gas. Yes, this is what we mean by a new brand of green capitalism. A quiproquo between a leader and his supporters coming from the business milieu. Modi could give land at a very low price, could even give loans, for instance, to Tata, at a very low rate of interest, very low interest rate, something like 0.1%. And of course, it could also give them access to SEZs, and therefore labor laws did not apply, taxes were very limited, and so on and so forth. In return, of course, he got financial support. Because to fight elections is expensive, and in Gujarat, and in the beginning, it was not easy. He had really to fight hard. He had to fight his own former party members, including Keshubhai Patel, and he had to fight Congress. So he had to saturate the public sphere by resorting to social media, to all kinds of media, and elections are expensive. More and more expensive in India. And that's something that we see at the national level. The same modus operandi is operating at the national level. The trajectory of Gautam Adani is almost as unique, as unprecedented as the trajectory of Narendra Modi. In 20 years, he became the richest man in India. That's a parallel trajectory. And of course, these two personas are completely indissociable. They can't be dissociated. That's probably for the first time in the history of India that we see this kind of nexus between the most powerful politician and the most influential businessman. But of course, this is not unique. You mentioned Orban in Hungary. We have a very similar pattern. There is a political economy of national populism. Now, as you said, that is not terribly good for the economy itself. This political economy is not resulting in development. The money does not go to education. The money does not go to health services. You know, in the book, I have compiled 10 of, or 12 pages of statistics comparing Gujarat to the rest of India, to other Indian states. And you see that Gujarat was lagging behind in terms of its investment in education and health. Money went to roads, to infrastructure. And the supply side kind of economy that was followed continued at the expense of the poor, and inequalities increased. A kind of gap developed between the rural part of the country and the urban part of the country. The middle class, the urban middle class, was the winner, was the main and probably only winner. Like today, at the national level, where we see a very similar pattern for very similar reasons. And again, the fact that a political economy that was there at the national, at the state level, could be scaled up at the national level is truly remarkable.
And that is probably maybe one of the most starkest signs of the Gujaratification of India itself, because in terms of Hindu nationalism and these types of sentiments, you know, that's prevalent across the north. But that distinct political economy, you know, has its, as you outline in your book, has its roots in the mercantilist, Hindu mercantilist culture in Gujarat, and that transformation from it being a kind of a soft Hindu identity to one that is Hindutva, and that marriage between all those elements has now been, and those actors as well, has been implemented at the national level. And it's really, you know, produced an economy that has significant top-level growth figures, but we see jobs growth lag behind. There's also a decline in FDI and foreign direct investment, and outsiders, you know, don't feel that they have a fair playing field in India because people like Ambani and Adani are given these undue privileges, and it's resulted in a very unequal society where, according to a new study, 9 out of 10 Indians earn less than the average income in the country, and so fewer than 10,000 individuals in a population of 920 million adults earn more than 2,000 times the average income of $2,800. So that has made India one of the world's most unequal societies. Now, a final question. What future awaits India after Modi? He's likely to win power in these elections, though I think some recent moves against the opposition suggest a lack of confidence. If he wins, he could rule for one more term. These days, look at the U.S., you know, politicians are ruling well into their 80s. But we see other figures rising in India, including the firebrand chief of the Uttar Pradesh state, Yogi Adityanath, who kind of fuses priestly power with political authority and violence. Do you see that as a distinct model and potential successor to the model Modi has established? I mean, he's functioned some in recent weeks as a kind of a high priest of this new India, but Adityanath really fuses religious power and political authority in an extremist form in ways that have not been seen in India ever. You know, Gandhi had those elements, but he was by no means a religious extremist. He was someone who espoused communal harmony. Do you see the Adityanath model as one that may come after Modi?
The very specific nature of politics that people like Narendra Modi develop creates a new form of uncertainty. There is no clear successor. The party doesn't have a clear second line of leadership. And everywhere, when the strong man disappears, leave the scene, after deinstitutionalizing politics, transitions have been complicated. To succeed a man like Modi is clearly a challenge. And that is in itself a problem. What kind of politics is this where when you create so much uncertainty about the future? Now, yes, Yogi Adityanath is one of the possible successors. He will have to win the next 2P elections still, and to win 3 times a state election in a state like Uttar Pradesh may not necessarily be very easy. Whether Delhi helps him to do so or not will be an interesting additional question. And as you say, he is not as popular as Narendra Modi is. And this is the problem for those who have to take over from the charismatic leader. They cannot be as popular as the charismatic leader who started the process of deinstitutionalization. So, can a man who is not so popular but is in power continue with the electoral process that he has inherited from the strong man? Or does he try to retain power by other means? We saw that in so many other places. You know, Maduro could never continue what Chavez had initiated because there was no way Maduro could win elections the way Chavez could win elections. Now, in the case of India, of course, the big difference is the role of RSS, because RSS is still very much there and can stage a comeback after Modi. He has been very particular about the marginalization of RSS. RSS doesn't play the role, even it played in the beginning of the first term of Modi, but still, the organization is intact and will probably try to be the arbiter, be the king-making, the way it used to be in the past. Now, there is another possibility. The opposition in India is closing ranks like it is closing ranks in Turkey, in Hungary, in Poland, the way it closed ranks in Israel, because to challenge the strongman, finally, all the parties realize that they have to be on the same page. So we have now a coalition of 28 parties, maybe more, and the coming elections will be a very important test for them, because if they achieve a very substantial seat adjustment, if there is only one candidate of the opposition against the BJP candidate in most of the constituencies, that may send a signal and that may make some difference. Well, BJP could never win more than 37% of the votes. Of course, these votes were so concentrated in the north and the west that it was easy to get a majority. But in the north and the west, in many states, the opposition used to be very divided. If it gets united, if there is a real seat adjustment, the future may be different.
So when we look at how India has transformed under Modi, in terms of the political economy, treatment of religious minorities, and the state of state institutions, do you think there's a potential for a reversal of these changes after Modi? How resilient is Indian society?
This is a very complicated question, because you may argue that a point of no return has been reached the moment the defense of the majority, the Hindu majority, the Hindu religion, has become sacred to some extent. As I said, majoritarianism leads to many illegal developments, but it's so legitimate. Its legitimacy reaches the level of sacredness for so many people that this red line may not be easy to cross again in the other direction. Who will make beef ban illegal? woven there to say conversions should be made easier. We will say there is no need to enumerate the citizens, and we will say migrants are welcome. You know, that's something the countries who have gone in this direction have never revisited. Now, as we said, India is diverse. There is still a form of federalism that is very resilient, and many people have never supported BJP. Never more than 37% of the Indians voted for this party. So there is room for maneuver. Whether that room is used is really the key question. I don't think anybody can really respond to this question now. You can speculate, but the future will tell us whether we have reached a point of no return for good or for a long time or not.
And that was Christoph Jafferlo of King's College London. Please subscribe to our show on your platform of choice, and thank you for tuning in.